I am Valentin Fuster from New York, and we are in Los Angeles in the scientific meetings of the American Heart Association. And it's a pleasure to try to pull together the most interesting trials of this particular meeting. And with us we have real experts in different fields, and I'm very pleased to introduce from the right to the left, first Dr. Lars Wallentin, who is professor of cardiology and director at the Uppsala Clinic Research Center University Hospital in Uppsala in Sweden. Then we have Dr. Rita Redberg, professor of medicine and director of medicine, cardiovascular services at the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center. Next, somebody you know, Dr. Clyde Yancey, Magistrate Professor of Medicine, Chief of Cardiology, Northwestern University, Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago. Then we have, on his right, Dr. Gilles Montelescott, Professor of Cardiology, Institute of Cardiology, Hospital La Pitié-Salpêtrière, Paris, France. Next is Dr. Robert Harrington, Arthur Bloomfield Professor of Medicine, and Chair Department of Medicine at Stanford University. I hope you remember that the heart is on the left, Robert.
I'll be okay.
I hope so. And here, finally, we have Dr. Noel Barry Mertz, who is Director of Women's Heart Center, and Director of Preventive and Rehabilitation Cardiac Center, Women's Guild Chair in Women's Health, Professor of Medicine at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. As you can see, this is a rather intimidating group of professors, and the question is how we put them online. This is not going to be simple, but we are going to try. Well, thank you very much for all of you to be here. And let's give an index of what we are going to do. We will be discussing three trials, the Freedom Trial, chelation therapy, and then we will go into the polypill. And then we will have three interesting curiosities that were presented in this meeting and see what your opinion is. So without any further introductions, we can go into this interesting trial, which is the Freedom study that we presented on behalf of the investigators of Freedom from 143 institutions around the world. This study is based on the concept that 25% of patients that we see in the cardiac catheterization laboratories are actually patients with diabetes and multivessel disease. And I think it was the VARI trial, the first one, that in a subgroup of patients with diabetes, it was suggestive that maybe surgery was the best mode of therapy. So this is a large randomized trial, which entailed near 2,000 patients with diabetes and coronary artery disease who underwent either PCI with drug-eluting stents or CABG. And the patients were followed for a minimum of 2 years and actually a maximum of 7 years with a mean of about 4 years. All patients were prescribed current recommended medical therapies. We were very hard at that, actually, for the control of low-density lipoprotein cholesterol. So the LDL, the aim was less than 70 milligrams DL. Control of blood pressure, our aim was less than 130 over 80. And hemoglobin A1C was about less than 70, what we were aiming at. What was interesting is the clinical hemodynamic and laboratory values were exactly the same in both groups. There was no difference. But what was striking is that the cholesterol level was high in 85%, hypertension in 85%, and then the BMI overweight an average of 29. So this is diabetes in patients who really are overweight, and I think this is an interesting aspect. And in terms of medications, they were exactly the same in both groups, with one exception that I think we'll have to discuss, and that is the use of clopidogrel in the group with CABG at 5 years was actually 16%, and in the group treated with drug-eluting stents was 46%. So it was a significant difference in the use of antithrombotic therapy long-term. Well, we have now to go into the primary outcome, which is the composite of death from any cause, non-fatal myocardial infarction or non-fatal stroke. Now I'm going to discuss the results. Before, I will say that the mean age of the patients was 63 years, 29% were women, and 83% had three-vessel coronary disease. And I'd like to make a comment. Any diabetic patient that develops coronary artery disease tends to be three-vessel disease, so it's not like the other population, which one-third, one-third, one-third. This is much more predominant, two- or three-vessel disease. Well, the primary outcome, and I repeat, the combination of stroke and myocardial infarction or death, the five-year rates was 26% in the PCI drug-eluting stent group and 18% in the group treated with bypass grafting, a very significant difference, an absolute value of 8% and a relative difference of 35%. Then it was looked individually at the three factors that make the primary endpoint. In myocardial infarction, 14% in the group treated with PCI drug-eluting stents, 6% in the CABG group. When we look at mortality from any cause, 16% versus 10%. The stroke rate, however, was 5.2% in the coronary group versus 2.4% in the group treated with the stents, but this didn't overshadow the overall favorable results for surgery. What was interesting was the patients were divided prospectively in at least 15 subgroups. No difference. In all the subgroups, the trend was always very favorable to CABG. And really, this leads to the issue of syntax that we all have been talking about in addressing how complex the disease is anatomically, no difference. Actually, a low syntax of less than 22, the incidence rate was 23% for PCI, 17% for CABG. A syntax of 23 to 32, 27 versus 17%. And a syntax of more than 33 is 31 versus 23%. So I will summarize the data by saying that in diabetic patients with multivessel coronary disease, CABG was of significant benefit as compared with PCI. MI and all-cause mortality were independently decreased, while the stroke was slightly increased. And there was no significant difference between the treatment effect of CABG on the primary endpoint, according to syntax score, or any other pre-specified subgroup. And we ended up our conclusion saying that CABG surgery is the preferred method of revascularization for patients with diabetes and multivessel coronary artery disease. This is a very biased group, actually, ladies and gentlemen. We don't have any surgeon here who could say from the beginning everything was fantastic, and let's go into the next topic. So let's now go into the discussion. Clyde, can you give us your sense of this study?
I'll play the surgeon and say this is fantastic and we should move on. Now, it really validates that there are important patient cohorts where the revascularization decision really should incline towards surgery. And it's probably because rather than looking at discrete disease, you're looking at systematic disease or systemic disease, and you're more capably impacting it with surgery.
Noel, why do you think that bypass surgery was superior anatomically or physiologically? What do you think?
Well, again, I think the fact that there were no subgroup differences by syntax score really tells you that it's a very disseminated disease process. And I think you have to start then also asking about what's wrong about angioplasty in this patient cohort. And you alluded to a higher use of the additional antithrombotic agents, and we can't really make those links. I didn't see increase in hemorrhagic strokes, but we do wonder about what's going on when people are, Renu Vermani tells us all the time that they're bleeding into plaque ruptures. I don't know, but I think it is a third trial. The Berry 1 definitely showed this. Berry 2 showed it indirectly. It wasn't a true randomization, but we saw that same finding. And here's number three. So I'm wondering, will we get it this time? Will we see altered behavior?
Now, Robert, one of the theories is that Diabetes is a very diffuse disease. You know, the average number of stents in this patient population was 4.2. So what that means is it's not focal disease, and I suspect bypass grafting, or the grafts might actually really bypass the whole process, and maybe the patient is protected because of this, where with the stents is not. What is your feeling about?
So from a cath lab perspective, the comments that have been made, I think, are what those of us that work in the cath lab have seen, that this is diffuse disease. It's not focal, and sometimes when you're doing stenting on this group of patients, you are picking a lesion that is stented, and you know you're leaving large areas of coronary disease untreated. And by going around it, I think you avoid some of that problem. You also avoid the problem. I'm going to guess that most of the patients in Freedom had an IMA, and so the use of arterial conduits, which we know has longevity attached.
85%.
So, you know, excellent contemporary surgery with arterial grafts. It's not surprising that it's one. It's nice to see, as Noel said, now we have a nice evidentiary chain. We have against balloon angioplasty, against bare metal stents, and now against drug-eluting stents. It's hard to argue against CABG being the preferred treatment modality.
Rita, what do you think about playing the devil's advocate? Now there are going to be fantastic new stents coming in, and the whole thing will fall apart. So what is your view about that?
My view is that that won't change a thing. And, you know, every time we have a study, first we had angioplasty and, you know, versus medical therapy, and the criticism, well, now we have bare metal stents, and then we had trials bare metal stents versus other medical therapy. Well, we didn't use drug-eluting stents. Now you did great, the Freedom trial with drug-eluting stents, and certainly people will say, now we have better drug-eluting stents. I think at some point you have to say, no, it's not the kind of device. This is revascularization is better with bypass surgery than with
I tend to agree
PCI.
Because since this is not a focal disease, I'm not entirely sure that much better stents are going to be made.
Well, that's right. And there's not really big differences except for target vessel revascularization between all of those generations of stents anyway.
Lars, let me ask you about the stroke. There's a very interesting issue here. The strokes were not at the time of intervention. In fact, the strokes in bypass surgery occur over the period of 5 years. And I wonder, see what is your opinion, since you're an expert in the field, could be that the use of clopidogrel and aspirin might be protective in the group that had the stenting over a period of years, and then the bypass grafting. There's really very few use the combination of drugs. And I wonder if the reason why strokes over time increase in bypass surgery is related to the antithrombotic therapy. I don't know what you think about
it. It's interesting. I mean, when you see the event curves over time, you see that there is, of course, a certain risk associated with surgery in the first period, and then the curves cross over. I thought that was the stroke issue, really, contributing to that. And, of course, it's a perioperative mortality contributing, but if there is a continuous raise in stroke risk, maybe atrial fibrillation might be another issue. You have atrial fibrillation starting after bypass surgery. It's not uncommon, so you might have a silent AFib contributing to stroke also. And of course, I mean, you have the lesions you are creating in the aorta in association with the bypass surgery.
So,
There has been a lot of discussion concerning whether or not we should continue the antithrombotic treatment with clopidogrel and other P-12 inhibitors, and no one really has any clear data because there is no randomized trial after CABG surgery. So just now we really don't know whether you benefit or eventually are harmed in relation to bleeding if you keep it for long term. But as you say, if there is a continuous increased risk, it's hard to understand the pathophysiology for that over the years. And then, of course, antithrombotic treatment might be one reason.
I never understood about industry on this because we wanted to, you know, we did this study on aspirin and dipyridamole who work on bypass grafts. And for years I have been going after to use the aspirin versus aspirin clopidogrel, and it has been impossible. I really don't understand why they didn't get into this. At one time they told me, well, bypass grafting is decreasing and certainly it's not going to be an issue. Well, I think bypass grafting is going to increase, and we still don't have the answer.
It's kind of interesting that in the Plato trial, where we had a substantial benefit in patients treated with bypass surgery by ticagrelor versus clopidogrel, there the treatment was uptaken again after the surgery. So there was a prolonged treatment over time. So maybe there are some hints that this should be continued.
We have to look at... Gilles, what are you going to tell your colleagues when you get back? You are not a surgeon, but you are not a defensive guy. I know you for years, and so what are you going to tell your colleagues?
You know, I'm going to tell them that the data are impressive, and when you have both options available in these patients, probably we should favor CABG over PCI in these diabetic patients with multivascular disease. Now, you know, the question comes up: the real life is different, and. What we would like to know as interventional cardiologists is probably how many of these patients were screened out during this screening phase, and how many were very simple cases and, you know, got an angioplasty because there was no question about this one or two stents that could solve the question. And what about the very serious cases that the surgeons do not want to operate on? And they send us cases with diabetes that they don't want to operate on. So I think that there is still room left for both techniques in the real life. But now when both options are available, you know, you have very strong data, and we should, you know, first convince the physicians, but also convince the patients that they need
anesthesia.
Well, I'd
like to make a comment here. 40% of patients refused to be on the trial. And, you know, the majority is because they wanted PCI. But now I'm going to ask the same question to Clyde, who is not an interventionalist, and to Robert, who is an interventionalist. And this is the issue. The problem is the patient gets into the cath lab, you do the angiogram, you find the disease, and then you ask the patient, we can open the arteries now. I think from now on, I think any patient with diabetes, the chances of having, that if the patient presents with ischemia, the chances of having three vessel disease is very high. Should we tell prior to doing an angiogram what the data is all about? Because that has been the problem, is we went to the angiogram, to the room, and the patient says, I prefer PCI, I don't want to be part of this study. What is your answer to this? And you, Robert, how do you view this?
I mean, I would hope that Bob and I are on the same page, because if you take a patient-centered approach to this, it really is about informing the patient, A, of the disease and the consequences of the disease and the treatment options, and what data are available to help inform that decision. And then for a different set of reasons, for convenience perhaps, a patient may go one way or the other. But Bob and I should be delivering the same message. Here's the disease, these are the ways in which it can be treated, and these are the benefits you can expect from one approach versus the other. And the very important caveat here, and Bob touched on this, is that the surgery really is contemporary. Use of arterial conduits and a very acceptable perioperative event rate, because otherwise it disqualifies some of the data.
I mean, those of us that have done coronary intervention for a long time remember that in the early days of coronary intervention, we used to have long discussions with our surgical colleagues and the medical colleagues taking care of the patients, and we would try to arrive at what the best treatment was. But as the technology got better, we got, I think, a bit ahead of ourselves and moved to the so-called ad hoc angioplasty, where you'd say, well, if we find something there, we're going to go ahead and fix it for you. So the technology helped us. Some of the language that we used influenced the patient, I think, in a certain way.
The feasibility.
And the feasibility. It was pretty straightforward. I think in this group of patients, Clyde's exactly right. What you need to say, if you have a diabetic patient with multivessel disease, I would say if you have any patient with multivessel disease, bad LV function, et cetera, you should stop. You should take them off the table. You should bring in the family. You should bring in your colleagues and say, here's the situation. Here's the evidence that fits this situation as best we can tell. You have to engage the patient in a conversation about what do they care about. Stroke is a bad thing to many people, and they should understand what the trade-offs are, but you need to do it in an evidence-based way, in a way that you're listening to the patient. What do they care about? What are they trying to achieve? And you need to be fair about how you're offering the alternatives.
I agree. Noel, we hope we can follow up for 5 more years, because, in fact, we submitted the grant to NIH yesterday, and the question is, we don't know, maybe the curves will continue to diverge, but could be the graphs we begin to be an attrition on the graph, so we really don't know, and this is an interesting situation. But I'd like to tell you some piece of data that we obtained, and actually was presented by Elisabeth Magnusson, which is cost effectiveness. It was very interesting, actually. In the first 2 or 3 years, PCI is more cost effective, but at the moment that, the, you know, 30% of the patients with PCI had to go through another procedure. And then at 4 years, cost effectiveness begin to be in favor of bypass. And then all the statisticians prolong things. I didn't understand all of this. But it seems to me that, that cost effectiveness is also in favor of bypass surgery. And I'd like to at least to know your opinion about this. And then I have more to say about another aspect.
I remember the first, the Spencer King, Bill Weintraub study. And, you know, you can pay now or you can pay later. You know, bypass was... But at the end of 5 years, it was about the same as what I remember. And it sounds like what you're describing is not that different. So I think it, again, throws it back into making good decisions and making, you know, reasoned decisions with a rationale that would support one over the other for that particular patient. I would like to just elaborate one additional thing, which is I bet you had a qualifying. You only allowed sites in Freedom that had good surgical mortality and good angioplasty mortality. So how relevant are these results to the community hospitals where most of our patients are getting their care?
It's a good point because we actually, the surgeons and the people doing intervention had to be qualified. So it was a control of the entities. However, there was no much difference between different countries. This is interesting. There was a trend in the same direction, but certainly there were, we call this certification for the trial on both groups.
And so you're testing a concept. I mean, this is, again, a proof of concept trial, really, and yeah. It'll be up to individual physicians and healthcare systems to try to decide what's best in their environment.
Rita, there's something we didn't present yesterday, but I like your opinion, and it's very troublesome. And that is, we try to treat these patients medically so aggressively with letters to the investigators and to the physicians. And it was very frustrating at the very end. A perfect risk factor profile was only obtained in 20% of patients. So with that in mind, we went to the VARI group and to the COURAGE group. Mm-hmm. They look at the diabetic patients, and they had exactly the same results. So I just make the point. Here we have a group of population that we are talking about intervention. The BMI is high, 29. Cholesterol is high. Blood pressure is high. And we all debate here what kind of intervention we should do, when in fact, I think we should really move into a different direction. We just submitted this for publication. It's very troublesome. We are not treating the patients properly. And it's not us. We try it. But whatever system we are into, we are not reaching the risk factor profile that we would like to do. And I'd like to know your reaction to this. Maybe, Noel, you might comment on this too.
Sure. Oh, it's very interesting. I mean, clearly, when you gave the risk factor profile and knowing they're diabetics, it's a very tough group. And, you know, I don't remember the average age, but, you know, they've been doing what they've been doing for a while, and so they have kind of entrenched habits. And it is harder. It's great that you tried hard with medical therapy, but it is tough to reduce risk factors. And I'm sure, you know, lifestyle changes, which, we all think are important, are not that easy, and I don't know if there was a reduction in BMI over the years, but certainly I think it's hard to really start significantly reducing risk factors without significant lifestyle changes, and that means heart healthy diet and activity. And
I would have a slightly different take on it. If you look at the Berry and the Berry 2D, we did actually really well. We hit lipid and hypertension goals 75 to 85% of the time. So the fallback, and I'll be interested in your 20% because it sounds like it's a combined risk score, is probably the A1Cs. And what do we know about that? I mean, you know, are we really supposed to be driving to goal? And then the weight. And, you know, in the Berry, everybody just kept gaining weight like the average American. Yet you see these great outcomes. So I'm not sure I'd be that disappointed about it. I think we know blood pressure. I think we know blood cholesterol. I don't think we know blood glucose yet. and I don't think anyone has the answer for weight.
Well, actually, our data didn't include hemoglobin A1c because this is very debatable.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the whole spectrum, I will tell you, it's disappointing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I only point this out because these patients reach the diabetic state, most of them, because they are not in the metabolic syndrome, perhaps, but they are getting there. And how we allow this to happen, well, is not the fault of anybody, but certainly I think at least my view of this trial, after thinking and being involved for 10 years, I reached the conclusion that we have to really pay attention to what is before all of this, because to try, it's too late what we are doing anyway.
We clearly have to do a better job with lifestyle. It's just nobody has that magic pill, and we need to keep working on that.
Well, we'll talk in a poly pill in a moment.
Yes.
Maybe it's not, so magic.
Yes, pill.
I just wanted to comment, because we kind of came at it from two different directions, but as I think Bob and Clyde, it's a lot. We all think about appropriate use of PCI, but I think this trial was interesting because when we talk about appropriate use, we talk a lot about patients who are getting PCI who perhaps, you know, are asymptomatic or didn't get medical therapy. But this is another group of patients that, you know, are getting PCI when they might have been better off or they might have lived longer, certainly if they had bypass surgery. And I think, as Bob said, we really need to look at how we're doing PCI because it changed a lot when we went to ad hoc PCI because, you know, the cardiac surgeons, and I wasn't at the meeting, but there was recently a JCO with PCPI, the AMA group, looking at performance measures, started looking at overuse and talked about PCI. And what I heard is that the cardiac surgeons were particularly unhappy that they're not included often in that decision. And this was even before your trial, but we know that the two other trials show that diabetics were doing better with multivessel disease and bypass surgery, but, you know, for whatever reasons, they're not getting referred as frequently. And so I think as a profession, we really need to relook at our acceptance of ad hoc PCI because we need to take the sheaths out,
I agree,
wake them up, and, you know, really do things differently than we're doing.
I would like just to finish by actually saying exactly what Bob said a few minutes ago, and that is the reality is that when we have these patients at the end of the road with multivessel disease, whether it is diabetic or not, you really have to think about surgical intervention.
And well, there's good news here, right? I think the way that angioplasty and surgery evolved, first the surgeon was king or queen, and then the interventional cardiologist became the king or the queen. And now, and I think the valve story is pushing us in this direction to say, you know what, neither person is king or queen. We've got to do what is best at that time for this patient. And I do think the field has evolved. And when you now see the interaction between interventional cardiologist and surgeon, it's a lot more collaborative than it was 15 years ago,
I think
a lot
more. The percutaneous valve replacement has helped.
Has helped
I think
a lot.
This will help too.
And in this setting, don't forget that these patients will see an evolution of their disease, attrition of their bypass, and they may come back at some point in the cath lab with an indication for a new revascularization.
Right.
And
right.
Guess what it's going to be?
It's not going to be repeat bypass.
Okay, so let's move now into a very interesting study. The so-called chelation therapy after myocardial infarction, the TACT study. This study was presented by Dr. Gervasio Lamas, which is from the Mount Sinai Medical Center in Miami. And it's very interesting the way he started his presentation. The literature is variously supportive and dismissive of chelation therapy, which promotes elimination of heavy metals from the body and likely has other effects as treatment for coronary artery disease. TACT was launched with backing of the National Institute of Health after the evidence for and against the use of chelation therapy. Well, it was interesting. I was originally at the NHLBI Council, I think it was 10 years ago, when the data of chelation was presented, and the results there were so equivocal that everything was dismissed. And now this comes back again, so I was interested to see. Well, here we are. This is a study of almost 2,000 randomized patients with coronary artery disease. And they were randomized on a kind of a solution that is used in the U.S. chelation clinics. And I just read that, you know, the combination of DTS, ascorbic acid, magnesium chloride, potassium chloride, sodium bicarbonate, B vitamins, procainamide, a small amount of a standard heparin and water. And the placebo consisted in saline with glucose. Well, the study actually went on with an objective of an endpoint of all-cause mortality, myocardial infarction, stroke, coronary revascularization, and hospitalization. This is an interesting study in the sense that it was randomized, and although a number of patients discontinued to be in the study, the number of infusions were actually 40. 76% completed at least 30. So there were obviously side effects, but let's go into the results. The hazard ratio for the primary endpoint for chelation therapy versus placebo was intention to treat was 0.82, a p-value of 0.035. When you look at the whole statistics, really was all very borderline, and actually each of the variables that play a role in the endpoint were negative. And actually what really the variable that made this to be a little bit significant was revascularization. However, interesting, since we talked about diabetes a minute ago, in a prescribed subgroup analysis, chelation therapy provided a stronger benefit for the primary endpoint in the 31% of the total population who were diabetics. And actually, the results, the p-value was 0.02. So at least this is something that came out from the study. But in the other subgroups, really, there was no very significant difference. I'd like to know your opinion, and I will go one by one about this issue of chelation therapy. Why don't I start with you, Lars? You can imagine now all the interventionists calling surgeons on one hand and the chelation guys on the other, and the interventions are out of business, according to what we have discussed thus far today.
Yeah, I think the results are very provocative, and of course, I mean, we like to dismiss them because it's so surprising. Maybe in the diabetics, there might be something there that we need to further investigate. That is my position, and I think we need additional data, what might have been happening here, and maybe in a new diabetic cohort with some more sophisticated analysis, even imaging, we might learn something. But otherwise, I mean, there are so many methodological issues that has been under debate in this trial. Very long recruitment time, period of termination of recruitment. There is a strange 20% more dropouts in the placebo group. That leads to certain suspicion that how could this be? How can you lose more patients, so much more patients in one arm versus the other?
It was a very long-term study. You don't know.
But still, I mean, so there are these question marks, and the endpoint that is affected is a softer endpoint. So I think, as also the commentator said at the session, that this will not change any recommendations of how these treatments will be used. And for us as scientists, there might be openings to investigate these issues more. But of course, this treatment is given outside the usual healthcare system.
So you are cautiously interested on the diabetic group.
Let's say that's a good conclusion.
Rita, you have many of these clinics here in San Francisco?
Oh, of course, that's all we do.
So what do you think?
Well, you know, I like science and I like evidence, but I have to say this trial troubles me because I don't get the whole thing. You know, I think before you start a trial, there should be a credible scientific basis for your hypothesis, and that's where this one just leaves me cold. I mean, I don't know what heavy metals and chelation have to do with heart disease, and I don't know why it should help. And so, you know, from the start, it's troubling. And then, you know, as Lars referred to, composite endpoints by themselves are not my favorites, and particularly because they're driven by the softest part of them and the squishiest, which is revascularization. And then to hear that it was revascularization that kind of drove this very kind of weak composite endpoint, I'm afraid it's not going to change my practice.
So she's not cautious. She's just negative. Clyde?
I think the right word is we need to pause. There's a lot to digest here.
And yes, I think so.
We should really pause and think about this. I don't want to reiterate the questions that have already been raised and the comments that have been made, but I do think there's one issue here that's worth noting. If we really are in an evidence-based world of medicine, what does that mean? It means that whenever there is a question, whenever there is a use of an approach that appears to be unbridled and of uncertain benefit, we should have the courage to assume some scientific position and take a look at it. Did we do it very well this time? I'm not certain. But at least we took the step to raise the question intelligently and say, is this a good thing or not? Again, we need to pause to really put this in context. But I feel pretty good that we are being true to whatever evidence-based medicine means and gave this a shot.
How much we should pause, you think?
My own feeling is that we should pause indefinitely.
Okay, Jules, what do you think?
I have no experience. I don't even know who I should
Nobody call has experience.
and clearly it has not been an option in our healthcare system. So clearly show me more data and we will adjust.
Robert?
So I was almost in Clyde's camp until the end. And what I mean by that is that I give the investigators a lot of credit. This is something that people were doing. We read that more than 100,000 patients annually are being treated with this thing. It's very expensive. They're paying out of pocket $5,000-$10,000. So it's people are doing it. It's an important question. I think the investigators asked the right question, which is in a randomized clinical trial. When they presented the evidence, they presented the data, they said 55,000 infusions they gave. Very complicated, good data quality, but a lot of issues surrounding some of the methods, how frequently they looked at the data, who looked at the data, was there any issue of differential dropouts. I think all of that we have to do pause and wait until the trial makes its way into peer review, wait until we can take a closer look at some of these secondary analyses. But like Lars, I'm cautious here, but optimistic that we shouldn't just drop this. If this is real in a diabetic population, which is now the hypothesis, it might be worth studying. And so I wouldn't advocate my patients go do this, but I would advocate that all of us think about if there was another study, would we participate? Which is one of the real challenges to getting trials like this done.
With a diabetic population.
With diabetic population, but you know the mainstream physicians wouldn't participate in this the first time around, but would we the second time?
Noel?
I've done CAM research, CAM, complementary and alternative medicine, and I would completely agree with what Bob and Clyde both said. I don't think we can throw this out. And now, I think I don't believe it. And if you look at the Cochrane search, there are actually 14 trials, not all of them randomized. So you know with publication bias, there's probably at least 20 trials. So this possibly is just the one trial that went in the opposite direction because all the prior trials were negative. So I, as a scientist, I don't believe it. But I don't think we can throw it out. I completely agree it needs to go through peer review, and we need to look at it carefully. And I would charge, the chelation providers, like we ask at the FDA, we need to see three trials that are consistent to approve a drug or a device. And that's what we need. So they've got one, maybe.
I think probably in HLVI supported this trial, I suspect, because of the widespread use of chelation therapy, but frankly, I still think we are square one, and we have to. It's like we have to move forward again. I remember this 10 years ago was the same issue. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, I think it's an interesting trial, and at least we should congratulate the investigators by their persistence. This was it took many years to get this going, and I suspect was actually very difficult. Good. Okay, so let's move now into, you mentioned the magic pill. let's talk about the poly pill. This is a study entitled Empire, Use of a Multi-Drug Pill in Reducing Cardiovascular Events, which was presented by the group at Imperial College in London, Dr. Simon Thom. And actually, the background is interesting. Actually, it was a meeting at McMaster's about a month ago. And the questions actually are four. One question is, should one consider a polypill in secondary prevention when we know what the patient must take, and one pill is easier than several? Should we consider a polypill in primary prevention, which is more questionable because everybody is different, and whatever you do, you have to have the clinical endpoints? These are the questions. And then the next issue is, what adherence? Is the polypill going to make people to take one pill better than several? And the other is the economics. And one of the things that we learn about the polypill, I didn't know this, but I learned over the years, is that what makes many of these pills expensive is the distribution. So if you have a single capsule that contains three pills, it's much cheaper because the delivery of the pills wherever you send them. So this is a study that was presented in this meeting, and actually the main goal here was adherence. The study actually included 2,000 patients. The hypothesis was adherence, and these patients were randomized into a combination of two different types of polypills. One was simvastatin, 40 milligrams, aspirin 75, lisinopril 10 milligrams, and atenolol 50. And the other was the same polypill, but instead of atenolol was hydrochlorothiazide. 88% of the patients in both treatments had cardiovascular disease, so this is almost a secondary prevention type of a study. And the results, I think, were interesting because opened the door to the issue of adherence. At 11 months, 15 months of follow-up, there was, in terms of adherence, 85% of patients in the fixed-dose combination were taking the drugs and 65% in the usual care. So it was a 21% absolute difference in terms of adherence. Then they look at systolic blood pressure, not much, from 129 millimeters of mercury to 131 in the control group. And LDL cholesterol was 2.1, in this case is 2.2. So I don't think there was in 15 months, there was not a very significant difference in the cholesterol level and systolic blood pressure, except was a trend. So I just would like to summarize that this interesting study, the EMPIRE study, shows that maybe there is merit to go into a polypill in terms of the adherence phenomenon. There are four polypills at the present time for secondary prevention. There are three. One is this one. There are two from India, and then there is ours. Ours actually has been approved already in three countries. And we are all going, all of four, through the FDA at this time. I think it's an interesting aspect because one of the problems that we have in coronary artery disease is only 40% of the people are taking all the pills that they are supposed to take. And this drop is in the first 6 months where the drop goes on. So I'm presenting this to you. It's an interesting trial. Maybe, Noel, you might start giving your opinion about this.
It obviously is a great strategy to test. Other people have also demonstrated that this can improve compliance. Delivering it to the patient also makes a big difference. So I think it's a great strategy. I noted at the very end of their adverse events that there were actually more adverse events in the polypill group compared to usual care. That was not anything that they were hoping to test, but they did report it. And I found that interesting with the recent REACH trial results with when you give beta blockers to people that aren't post-MI, it doesn't look like it's maybe a good thing. That's just registry data. But I think this reiterates to me we have to have MACE trials.
Yeah, I agree. I think the question here, four pills are many, though. Anyway, this doesn't explain the side effects because the others were supposed to take the four pills too. But
yeah, but they took more.
Yeah, yeah. There were other pills too
they
that were added
more.
To these. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lars, what do you think about first about this study and then about the concept?
Well, I think it's a very important trial to find out adherence. It is not really surprising that you get better adherence if you take everything in one pill. I mean, that I think that almost could be expected, but that you influence risk factors will be important. But still, I mean, there are many questions remaining. How does this fit into usual health care? I mean, for a preventive situation without other diseases, then you can imagine that it works. But for patients with comorbidities, with other agents, with possible interactions, of course, we have one trend to tailor, to personalize medicine, and then we have this trend to simplify and give one pill for everything. And these go in different directions as far as I see it. One is probably more costly. The personalized way is more costly. The polypill approach, I think, would fit very well into a system like in India where you have underprivileged patients and you are not that well educated and you are focusing on overall health care of population.
And it's much more economic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's where I see it, kind of in a stable patient, secondary prevention without too much comorbidity.
Clyde, one issue about this polypill, do you know what the cost is of making a polypill? I will tell you. It costs us $15 million. And you know why? Because one polypill is out of 100 testing. You have to use different dosages because they interact. And that is when you have the polypill together and you take it, the release is different than when you take the pill separately. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is this field is not as simple as people think. Mm-hmm. You put three pills together and it's going to work. It's a tremendous amount of work. And actually many people started to develop polypills and they have to quit on economic basis because it's a tremendous enterprise.
But Valentin, I know that you were at the opening session for this meeting because you spoke eloquently in that session. But additionally in that session, we heard a very provocative discussion about frugal innovation. And it was driven by an observation that gave me a chill. The majority of people worldwide with cardiovascular disease are on no therapy
exactly.
to control their disease process, zero. And something like a polypill requires that we think very differently than we've thought before. This isn't about proving superiority, that it's better than anything else. This is about proving that it's actually okay and accepting okay, understanding that there's a large population that doesn't mm-hmm. come to Palo Alto or Chicago or San Francisco that's getting nothing. And so I think we should change our prism here and think about population health, at least in this one area.
I agree. Actually, our polypill was approved first in Guatemala and then was approved by Mexico and then Argentina. And we are doing all these trials, but it's already being approved. And one of the reasons that the governments are approving, because this is exactly what you say, people are not taking the medications, and this might be a possibility. At least they take something.
Right.
And economically, it has tremendous implications not to take anything after you had a heart attack.
Anyway. But when I listened to the opening, it was the Connor lecture with
right.
Stephen McMahon, I asked myself, why are we talking about the rest of the globe? This is the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
We know that in mm-hmm. the MI free trial that giving people free medicines meant that at the end of the year, 11% were taking the combination of beta blocker, statin, and an ACE inhibitor. We're no better. We can talk about personalized medicine and running your genome and manipulating all of these things. But I would say, Clyde, that average care is better than no care. And right now, many of our patients get no care.
I
would say
right.
the polypill fits well in the U.S. because we do a terrible job of getting our patients on medicine.
And in some populations in the U.S., it's no different than third world countries.
So this leads you to a very important question. Is this, I cannot at least digest yet personalized medicine in cardiovascular disease, because when you see everything we are discussing today, now if you decide to go personalized when people are not taking medications, I think in cancer and, you know, certain types, I really believe on that. But in cardiovascular disease, I think we have to do first a job for
health.
Everybody and then go into personalized. What do you think?
Yeah, you're correct. And I think this body pill is fine and probably, plenty of countries and healthcare systems. When I think of some Western countries, Sweden is certainly a good example, my country also, where, you know, everything is reimbursed. And when we teach to reach the goals for every pill we give, I don't see a bright future for the polypill. And we tend to, you know, adjust therapy on an individual basis, and we have presented at this meeting a trial of individualized therapy, and we had a hard time to show benefit. But still, we are struggling, and we have started other studies.
Rita, can you give us the last Rita, can you give us the last word about the polypill?
Well, I certainly think a pill people take is better than one they're not taking, and so that's great. As Laura said, it will be interesting to show outcomes, but the potential, particularly in third world countries and perhaps in the U.S., is very interesting, and I think it was a great study.
You wanted to make a comment, I think?
No, it's obviously very different between different healthcare systems. So, I mean, in the Swedish society, we even have a registry to monitor all patients post-MI. So they go into a registry monitoring secondary prevention, including target levels. So, I mean, we cannot go for a polypill everywhere. Then we would reduce our ambition much too low. So the ambition might be allowed to be higher, but we should go for it in populations that are underprivileged. And hopefully, I mean, the healthcare system will be better, even in the U.S., I hope. Maybe today's election might be a decisive factor.
Good. Well, thank you very much. It is an interesting discussion. Now, I would like to touch into what we call three curiosities, if you find the same. The first curiosity actually is colchicin. And I like this hard torque statement. It starts saying, you can teach an old dog new tricks. They say, but Australian researchers may have discovered that an old drug, colchicin, has a few useful tricks yet. Well, this is a very interesting study. Frankly, I like to know your opinion. This is a study that was presented in this meeting by Dr. Niedorf from the Heart Research Institute in Perth, Australia. And this has to do with the use of low dose colchicin, and was a randomized study, open blinded, and was done in patients with coronary artery disease who had a myocardial infarction. And to make a long story short, just mentioned there was not a large number of patients, which actually 532. They were followed for a minimum of 2 years, and actually the endpoint was a combination of acute coronary syndromes, out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, a stroke, non-cardiombolic ischemic stroke. And the results were quite striking, actually. This combination of endpoints occurred in 16% of the patients that were treated with placebo, and in 5.3% of patients that were treated with colchicin. And actually, colchicin was a low dose. In fact, the study is low-dose colchicin. And, you know, when you look at this, certainly we all talk about inflammation maybe involved in atherosclerotic disease, and certainly colchicin probably is better anti-inflammatory drug when you talk about neutrophils and so forth, and it is aspirin. So I think this is a very curious study that maybe will make news in a few years, being a reality. Clyde, what do you think?
I am intrigued, encouraged, and boy, what a great idea to take an old drug and find a unique application. But I wouldn't let that hijack the scientific questions that still need to be answered.
Small number of patients.
Is it just inflammation, small number? What's really driving this endpoint?
Yeah. Robert, it's interesting. This drug is very cheap across the world. It's very expensive in the United States.
It goes back to my polypill comment. But, you know, at these meetings the last few years, we've seen a series of trials presented with new uses of colchicin, preventing pericarditis post-CABG, reducing the risk of atrial arrhythmias in certain groups of patients. And it raises a lot of interesting questions around the role of inflammation in the development of different vascular diseases. So from my perspective, this is an interesting observation. It's worth thinking about and perhaps even studying it further. Plus, it was a trial with a great name, as you've pointed out, Lodoco.
But let me push back on Bob. I mean, I'm aware of the same data that you've seen, that it really looks like this is doable and there's benefit. Would you not use it now?
No. I don't think that the evidence around using it is convincing. It's a small number of patients. It's the confidence around that is wide. I want to use things that work.
See,
you did too.
No, I do too. But my only question about it is whether or not we can take those patient populations and extrapolate the information from there to here. But I don't want to be dismissive.
I'm not being dismissive at all. In this case,
I'm seeing something that's very encouraging.
Agreed. So study it.
So let's do a meta-analysis. I would do a meta-analysis of all the studies done with colchicine, and just to put it together. In every meeting, something comes out. You know, it came out with pericarditis years ago, with now atrial fibrillation post-op, now with coronary artery disease. Maybe we are in front of something that we are not paying attention to. Noelle?
I would commission a larger study, but I think there's mechanistic understanding about why it could work. So I would I get concerned when we just keep adding more and more pills, and I think patients stop taking other pills, and I think that's what you were alluding to. I wonder, just to regress about the chelation therapy, if it wasn't filtering out some of the over-the-counter supplements that people are taking, and that may actually, in this day and age, help people. So we have to study these things more.
Yeah, interesting. Lars, what do you think about colchicine?
Well, I think, as Ada says, intriguing and should be further studied. I mean, I'm involved in one of these large studies with new anti-inflammatory agents. 15,000 patients are required with the expected effect we might have from this, and I think it's in another trial. So 30,000 altogether with the first anti-inflammatory agent that might be positive. And if the results with colchicine had been seen in that trial, it would since long have been stopped by the DSMB, because no one can see this data without stopping a trial. So I am intrigued, but I would like to see the mechanism studied and also prospective trial.
Many people thought to start patients on prednisone, and the reason why it was not done, one is the side effects, and the other is because the experience of prednisone in myocardial infarction has been terrible. But here we have a drug, colchicine, that certainly causes some gastrointestinal problems in about 10-11% of people, but maybe there's something there. So, Gilles, can you give us the last word about colchicine? Are you going to start taking it?
Certainly not. I would be on the side of caution because, as you said, corticosteroids have been tested and it was not good at all. NSAIDs are not the friends of coronary artery disease. We had a large trial at Apex MI with a new anti-inflammatory drug, which was totally negative. So I would be very careful and would wait for more data.
Rita?
I agree. And the issue of GI side effects is one that a lot of patients stop taking colchicine for, but I think certainly worthy of further study. But I think the issue of why colchicine in the last 2 years has gone from a drug that's pennies a day to it's now $5 a tablet in the U.S. is an interesting story, because colchicine has been around for about 300 years.
Yeah.
There have been randomized controlled trials that show clear benefit for gout and for familial Mediterranean fever. Okay. And recently there was a small randomized trial sponsored by, I think, URL Pharma, where they showed a benefit, and then because it had been around before 1938 when FDA started regulating drugs, it had been grandfathered in. Now it was now considered a new drug for the treatment of gout, and so this company got market exclusivity for several years on this drug that had been around forever that other people had done trials of, and jacked up the price to $5 a pill. And so I think it kind of points to an issue that we're going to have with other drugs that have been around for as long as colchicine, because I don't think that's a good system.
Well, it's interesting. Historically, this may make this drug may make history going forward. I'd like to finish by just a comment. I'd like to hear from you of two studies that were presented that actually were negative, but we see so many patients taking multivitamins today. Apparently they say about 25% of the population takes multivitamins, at least in the United States. And then the omega-3 story. In terms of the multivitamins, this is actually the physician's health study involving more than 1,400 or 14,000 physicians age 50 or older. They were randomized originally, remember, was vitamin E, beta-carotene, and vitamin C, and the whole older results were actually negative. And there was a fourth group that were on multivitamins. And actually, the results just came back the same than the others. In a follow-up of 11 years, the incidence rate of events, of a combined events, the usual, were exactly the same in both groups, those who were taking multivitamins and those who were on placebo. So this is a negative study. There is a trend in favor of preventing cancer, but not a specific type of cancer. This is very borderline. But it seems to me that we should not advise to take multivitamins to make your heart healthier. But before I ask your comments, the other one is fish oils and omega-3. And if I can summarize this story, there are 20 studies done in coronary disease. And there's only one or two that post-myocardial infarction for the first year, it might be helpful. But when you go into all the other studies, you end up with very little. There are studies done on cardiomyopathy. There are studies done, one of presented here, on atrial fibrillation, actually, in which, in fact, the name of the study was Forward, the study. It just didn't work. And then there is another one that was presented, the OPERA study, which is patients to in time to prevent post-op atrial fibrillation with omega-3, which was in a high dose and didn't do any good. So I just like to pull these aspects together, and that is the use of multivitamins and the use of omega-3 in is so prevalent in the patients that we see every day that I really like to know your opinions. Let's start with the French population. Are you having so much multivitamin there that we have here?
No, not at all. A lot of wine, red wine.
That's good.
And you have some vitamins in the wine, but you know, otherwise it's not in our culture.
It's interesting.
We have a different approach. So we do not deal with patients taking multivitamins, asking for multivitamins. It's clearly not in our culture, and we are glad with this.
Omega 3s also is not in your culture.
We have an indication in post-MI patients, and the use is very low.
What about your culture, Swedish culture?
Yeah, I think Swedish culture is that people go a lot and buy multivitamins. I mean, we have limited amounts of sunshine, very dark climate, and historically there have been a limited supply of vitamins before we had this internationalized world, so that it is kind of a habit to provide multivitamins, especially in the dark half of the year, and people have also been keen on omega-3 fatty acid and fish oil for a long time. So I think there has been a general belief that this is helpful against almost everything, not only heart disease. So even if we show that it's not good for heart disease, I think that people will still be taking it against whatever is out there, because it's considered, fairly neutral. It doesn't harm you, and maybe I get a bit more vital by taking
it. Actually, it says in the presentations, it's true, and they make a comment that, at least based in my experience with patients, it's true. Most of the people who take multivitamins, they are not taking care of their blood pressure or anything. It seems multivitamins is the answer to all their problems. But then there's a group of population, of obsessive population, that I don't know what they eat. They eat nothing. And they're and on top, they have all these bottles of multivitamins. Rita, what about in San Francisco area?
Well, we're with the French. red wine, fruits and vegetables. You know, we've had study after study looking at dietary supplements and vitamins, and none of them have shown a benefit. We published a study in archives last year from the Iowa Women's Health Study that actually showed increased mortality in women who were studied for 30 years taking multivitamins. And, you know, I think there's a real, especially among Americans, and like you say, either the very healthy who just can't, you know, just want to be healthier, and then the people that have no interest in really following a healthy diet and, you know, exercising regularly, and they would much rather take a multivitamin. But unfortunately, none of these pills will replace, you know, a healthy diet, a little wine, and regular exercise. And I think this study confirms that.
So,
what about the Chicago area?
Yeah, you know, I'm still new to Chicago, and I'm not sure. But what I'll tell you is that I'm a big fan of healthy diet, red wine, and exercise. But I don't think we should be glib on this subject. This is a huge industry in the United States. Vitamins are widely offered and sold and marketed throughout our culture. And we really ought to think carefully about the impact here, not that we should be hesitant, but when we say that there's no demonstrable health benefit, we really are tapping into a big, big part of our industrial complex, and there are implications. But I would stand firmly behind these data and say I don't see the benefit of taking that route, preferably diet, wine, and exercise. But there would be a quantum shift in the way our culture exists if it really is taken to heart.
I don't think we are advocates enough to really reject the use of
right.
multivitamins.
Right.
I mean, we're talking with our own patients, but there is not a body of advocacy, I think, that should have an impact across the country. You think it will never work politically?
Well, I mean, we don't regulate dietary supplements and vitamins. So we know we have the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, and it does not require any data. And so the problem is, I think people are getting hurt because at best they have expensive urine, but there are people that think they're getting health benefits they're not getting from this. And you're right, it's a huge industry. It's over $30 billion. But I worry that, you know, people think they're getting something and they're spending very precious money they don't have, and that perhaps is better on prescription medications, on these pills that they think are going to guarantee health. I have patients that come in and show me ads, and, you know, direct, there's a lot of advertising for these pills that guarantee, you know, energy all the time and all kinds of answers that, and they don't have to have studies to back those up. So I'm glad they did this study, but I don't think that we should continue supporting industries without.
Let's leave vitamins aside. And let's wrap up, and maybe just a short comment from each of you. What do you think about the meeting and the discussion? What point you will take, or what would you take home, Noel?
In general, not just fish oils.
For anything. No, not about fish oils, not about vitamins.
Yeah, no, I think freedom is hopefully a final stake in the sand that we're going to start trying to do the right thing. And I'd like to see that roll out.
What I liked about the meetings this year is that it puts forward the notion that we need science to guide practice. Fish oils don't work. Vitamins don't help reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. Chelation therapy might work, and bypass surgery is clearly superior to angioplasty in diabetic patients for multivessel disease. Wow, that's a lot we've learned, but it took a lot of work behind that, and I think it reiterates we need more of it.
You're the chairman of scientific sessions next year.
And I'm counting on all my friends here to come back and help us.
Okay, good. Message?
Yes, we see more and more negative studies, so we are happy to have one positive study, which is freedom. And, you know, the colchicine data, it's a small study, but it's positive. It's going in the right direction with a new hypothesis, so I like it.
Good. Clyde?
I love the fact that we have more evidence now. And I also love the fact that in a separate discussion, as you and I have discussed, we've got some great stuff on heart failure now, which is brand new. So I think it's been really an exciting meeting.
Good. Rita?
I agree. I think, you know, I very much appreciate randomized controlled trial data and evidence, and I think we had a lot of great studies, freedom being the highlight, and a lot of other studies at this meeting, so it was really exciting.
But?
Yeah, in addition, there has been a lot of other exciting information on even new concepts under development. Stem cells have been ongoing almost when we are sitting here. And I also think a lot of educational discussions and how to implement new treatments that we have been seeing over the last few years, and why don't we implement treatment? That's another, I think, important issue just now. We have new treatments that reduce mortality, that reduce events, that reduce side effects. Still, we don't implement them? And how can we expect an industry to move forward with new treatments if we are not implementing the ones we just have got? And I think that's an issue, maybe an economical issue, that we have to discuss for the future.
Well, look, thank you very much for having this very nice discussion. And as I said to you at the beginning, I was going to be intimidated by this group of professors, but you know the answer. They are very human, so they were not intimidating. Well, thank you very much for having with us today, and thanks to all of you. Thank you.